This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryan over there. And there's Jerry Rowland there. And this is Stuff You Should Know, an outdoorsy edition if there ever was one.
Is that your American Masters voice?
Kind of. It's got a little Bob Ross to it.
Happy birthday, Bob Dylan, by the way. Happy 80th birthday to one of the great legends, speaking of great Bobs.
Oh, okay. I was like, how is that apropos of anything?
Well, you said Bob. Made me think of Dylan. There's a lot of online congratulations going around.
That's good.
So throw me in there. I know you don't care about Bob Dylan, but no, I do.
That's fine.
And you apparently don't care about John Muir, because, boy, you were snotty about this.
I have no problem with John Muir. Well, that's not exactly
He's not the
true.
Only one. A lot of other people doing stuff.
It's a whatever. Let's just get into this, shall we? So we're talking John Muir today, and that name might sound familiar if you're not a member of the Sierra Club. If you're a member of the Sierra Club, you probably just dropped to your knees and did the secret sign when I said John Muir.
Sure.
Just had to do it again because I said John Muir. And there it goes again. Every time we say John Muir, the Sierra Club members have to do something weird.
Or if you've ever hiked any portion of the John Muir Trail that was named after him.
Is that in Yosemite?
It's in California.
Okay.
Yeah. It's part of it's in Yosemite, I think. I should have looked that up.
Well, he is – I asked that because he's basically synonymous with Yosemite. He was a huge driving force in getting Yosemite into national park status and then fully becoming the Yosemite that we understand it today.
Have you ever been?
No, I haven't. And I really want to because I saw some pictures online. And it looks really nice.
I've been to quite a few amazing national parks in the United States. Not all of them. Still haven't been to Yellowstone. But I've been to a lot of them. And Yosemite is really – it's really up there. Mm-hmm. It is one of the more special places.
It looks like it.
It's pretty incredible.
So John Muir, he played a huge role in Yosemite becoming a national park. But also, like, it's really kind of selling short the impact that he had on the creation of our national park system. Mm-hmm. But also, like, the idea of what a national park is, what wilderness is, what needs to be protected, how we protect it. Mm-hmm. He was certainly not working in a vacuum in that sense. He was kind of tapped into this larger way of thinking, for better or worse. But he was a huge driving force. And one of the reasons he was a huge driving force for getting America into preserving wild spaces in the face of the second industrial revolution that was just minting money and building railroads and just turning America into a powerhouse. Because he walked the walk for sure. He was not just some, you know, Eastern, you know, greenhorn who had never set foot in the wilderness but liked the idea of it.
Yeah, right.
He went and lived it for sure. Like, he did some really wild stuff while he was living in Yosemite at the time.
Yeah, in fact, later when he was in his late 30s, he was hooked up with Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was older, and they really bonded. They went on a camping trip together, and I think Emerson was like, what you need to do is come back to Boston.
Emerson or Thoreau?
Emerson.
Okay.
And he said, you need to come back to Boston and be among the intelligentsia advocating for this stuff. Mm-hmm. And at the time, John Muir was like, no way, man.
No way, dude.
Like, I gotta be in the woods, bro.
I'm a rocker, dude, through and through.
Yeah. And it would not be until later in his kind of mid to late 40s that his life was kind of in two parts. It was the wild exploring and categorizing and botanical categorization of everything he could find.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mid-40s on when he was very much a political advocate and kind of did that because he felt he had to. He would have rather – he had a T-shirt on the whole time that said, I'd rather be camping.
Right. But I also saw that he went back after a little bit of a hiatus, I think like a nine-month hiatus toward the end when he finally left Yosemite for good.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt like he was an intruder there. Like he felt like his time there was done, and he knew that he had to be out of there in the world to advocate for it. For the preservation of this area, but also that he felt like that chapter was closed. So
interesting.
Yeah, I mean that's they always say know when it's time to leave, and I guess he did.
They always say that.
So let's talk about John Muir starting even younger than that, though.
Yeah, let's start with minute one.
Okay,
he was born April 21, 1838. He of Scottish heritage. He was born in Dunbar.
Yeah,
and came to the U.S. when he was 11. He and his family settled in Wisconsin, eventually in Hickory Hill on an 80-acre farm near Portage. His father was a very stern Calvinist.
Mm-hmm. Super religious.
Yeah, like it kind of, if you ever seen the movie The Witch, sort of along those lines.
Wow,
that's
such a great movie.
Punishment was very heavy and strict.
If you beat your child because they haven't memorized a Bible verse to your satisfaction— you may be over the line.
I think I'm not going to go so far as to say there was physical abuse. But,
oh, there was.
Oh, there was with his father?
Yes, for that reason.
Okay. I mean, I saw like corporal punishment, but like, you know, these days spanking a kid is abuse. Like, I don't know where it fell on the meter back then.
I can't say where it fell on the meter. I can't say either. But yes, he would be.
But today he would be in prison.
Probably, yeah.
But one of the reasons John Muir became John Muir is because of his father, because the wilderness in Wisconsin was his refuge and his literal escape to kind of get away from him. So who knows what would have been, you know, what would have happened had his father not been like that even.
Yeah, and I don't want to fully mischaracterize his father, just partially. He was very stern, but John Muir was convinced that his father loved him still and cared about him and was even maybe a little bit proud of him in the ways that he deviated from what his father wanted for him. And one of the main ways that he deviated from him was in book learning, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like all his father was concerned with was his boys working the land, farming. Knowing farming and knowing the Bible. They didn't need to know anything else. But that wasn't enough for John Muir. He was basically a born tinkerer, a born engineer. But he did not have free time. His father was like, you're either working in the field or you're studying the Bible or you're getting hit with the switch by me.
Right.
It's one of those three things is what you're doing for all of your waking hours.
Yeah.
And so John Muir hit upon the idea of expanding his waking hours. And so as a youth, he started waking up at 1 a.m. so that he could have 5 hours to himself between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m. when he was expected to start working on the farm to just read or tinker or invent. And he actually used that to really great effect.
Yeah, so he made a lot of little inventions. There was one called an early rising machine, which was basically a alarm clock attached to his bed that would quite literally tip his bed up and tip him out of it.
Yeah.
I don't get the feeling that he needed it because he's getting up at 1 a.m. anyway.
His father used it.
Did he really?
Yeah.
But he eventually would go to the state fair in Madison in 1860
mm-hmm.
with a lot of his inventions and was sort of a boy wonder inventor.
Well, he was 22 at the time.
Well, but he was – I think he had invented a lot of this stuff in his teen years too, though.
Right. But imagine like, you know, at 22 in the 1880s or 60s.
Yeah,
you're like,
almost retired.
You're like imagine the middle-aged guy showing up at the 4-H fair being like, can I enter?
One of the things, a big relationship in his life that would last throughout his life, he studied with a man named Ezra Carr, and his wife, Jean Carr,
mm-hmm.
became a really big mentor for him and exposed him to you know, botany, basically. Like, she was a scientist. And he loved the outdoors, but she was like, hey, but botany is like a real science to it.
Yeah.
And was a really big influence in his life, introduced him to Emerson later, like literally picked out a wife for him that was like, this is who you need to marry.
Yeah, because apparently she can support you and all your matchmaker then too.
It seems like it.
Because they loved each other very much. And she was totally fine with his comings and goings and all that. And
sure.
They were good together.
Comings and goings is in going
to like Australia or Japan or something.
That made it sound a little bit like, you know, dalliances.
No, nothing like that. No, as a matter of fact, I read that he left Yosemite at one point because of unwanted attention from a woman.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
He was like, he was camping and this lady hiked by and looked at him and he's like, I'm out of here.
Sailor.
Well, he was an interesting dude in that he was a bit like a hermit, but apparently also really enjoyed these one-on-one conversations with people he would meet.
Yeah.
Along
the
way.
He was kind of billed as a wild man of the wilderness.
Yeah.
But he very much craved and needed human interaction as well. It was very odd. It's usually one way or the other in that sense, you know?
Yeah. So he's working eventually the industrial part of his life because he was such a good tinker and engineer.
Uh-huh.
He got work doing stuff like that. And in March of 1867, he's working at a carriage parts shop in Indianapolis.
Oh,
an awl pierced, like literally went into his eye and pierced it. And for a while, he was blind in both eyes because of that.
It was such a bad wound that his other eye was like, I'm out too.
Yeah, just because I feel bad for my buddy over there.
Sympathy blindness.
And this was a very monumental injury because after this, he was like, you know what? Forget this stuff. I don't want to ever be around another machine with moving parts again.
Right.
And I just want to walk.
He said that he bade adieu to all my mechanical inventions, determined to devote the rest of my life to the study of all the inventions of God.
Yeah, he stayed religious. We should point out
he was super religious.
It's not like because of his dad he went atheist or something.
No.
Like in all of his writings and talking about the natural world.
It's all Ezekiel, Ezekiel, Ezekiel.
Well, it was all very spiritual and God-oriented. He was like, this is my church, though.
Exactly.
The outdoors, which I can, you know, respect on a certain level.
He loved creation with the capital C.
Sure.
So when he's wandering, like he really wandered. He was kind of a Johnny Appleseed type almost. He walked from Indiana, mm-hmm. where I guess he recovered from his awl injury,
mm-hmm.
All the way down to Cedar Key, Florida on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
It's like 1,000 miles. He just walked down there and pretty quickly too. Caught malaria in Cedar Key, almost died, recovered, sailed to Cuba from there, sailed on to Panama from there, and made it all the way to San Francisco. And apparently there's a story that may or may not be true where he got to San Francisco, was immediately overwhelmed by the hustle and bustle of the city.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And said, what's the fastest way out of the city?
Yeah, I think that's the deal. He got right out of there.
And the guy he asked said, well, where do you want to go? And he said, anywhere wild. And he pointed him in the direction of Yosemite and apparently walked 300 miles to Yosemite and fell in love.
That's right. And on the way out of town, someone yelled, don't forget the rice-a-roni. It's the San Francisco treat. And he went, what?
Sure.
Jerry's like...
Jerry liked it.
Disgusted by that joke. Yeah, he split immediately to get out there and went to California. And
who's in California?
Well, yeah.
He went to Yosemite.
He went to Yosemite.
But he walked.
Right. And he walked because... for a very specific reason. He walked because that was the most intimate way to see the botanic and write about the botanic world around him.
Yeah, because this was a time when you could be like, remember our Bone Wars episode that you hooked us up with?
Who?
Bone Wars.
Oh, sure.
Like this was a time where like you or I could just start studying books and be like, okay, I'm a paleontologist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm a botanist. Okay, I'm a geologist. All this stuff. These fields were so young that anybody who had like half a brain and like a pencil and a piece of paper could basically contribute to the field.
Sure.
And that's what I guess he was doing along the way. He definitely did that in Yosemite.
Oh, yeah. He did that everywhere he went. And it's a good lesson too to like, I remember when Emily and I lived in L.A., I had a couple of times where I had to drive to my mechanic and leave my car, and this was pre-rideshare services, and taxis were basically non-existent in L.A., so I would walk these long distances home, and you notice everything. Mm-hmm. Like these neighborhoods that I drove around every day all the time.
Right, yeah.
And you would just notice, like, and study every house, every mailbox, every driveway.
Yeah.
And it's really just a lesson to people to, like, to walk places when you can.
There's a group in the UK, I think, called Amblers.
Yeah. We talked about them once.
Okay. And they're basically, I think their motto is they're dedicated to the idea that human locomotion should be no more than like 3.5 miles an hour,
which is about the
speed that you walk, you know?
Yeah.
And then that's how you take in everything. It's absolutely true.
Yeah. My two favorite speeds are 2.5 miles an hour and like 95 on the expressway.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
One of the two.
So John Muir makes it to Yosemite. Have we taken a break yet?
Nah, let's take a break.
I think this is a great place for a break, don't you?
He's
entering Yosemite for the first time, everybody. Imagine it.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today. Okay, so John Muir's in Yosemite, and he decides that he needs a little bit of work. I think he stayed the first time for like 10 days. And a lot of people who know some about John Muir, and especially associated with Yosemite and the national parks, basically think he showed up in Yosemite and never left and lived and died there. That's not true.
No.
He lived there for about a six-year period, I think.
Yeah, out of 76 years of his life.
Yeah, so 1868 to 1874, I believe.
Yeah, and those were a very, like, California just totally rocked his world.
Yeah.
Once he got out there.
Yeah, because he was living in Indianapolis. So, I mean, basically anywhere would rock your world. But imagine showing up to California in the mid-19th century or late 19th century and seeing it.
Yeah, and especially if you've I remember when I did my big out west trip years ago with my best friend over like 4 months. In the summer, driving through Utah and Arizona and everywhere, it was just so blazing hot. Mm-hmm. And then when you drive over, especially Southern California, when you drive over that mountain range, it's like someone turned on the air conditioning.
Oh, yeah.
And I just remember thinking, like, man, imagine what it must have been like for westward expansion when they finally got into the L.A. Basin.
Yeah.
We're just like, whoa. Like,
so it's this is where I'm staying. In the L.A. Basin?
Yeah, I mean, you go over that mountain range, and it's just the Pacific Ocean breezes are just kind of locked in there.
Wow, it's really hot on the other side then, huh?
Yeah, like Death Valley is hotter than Los Angeles.
I'm not up on my California geography.
Yeah.
I think Germany's landlocked. Give me a break.
No, it's very lovely and cool near the coast.
So, yeah, I can imagine what it must have been like as like a 19th century traveler or something like that. But when John Muir got there, as I was saying— He stayed for like 10 days and was like, I need some money. And he went back. I guess he hitched a ride or else walked back, got some more money. And then he came back to Yosemite. He's like, I'm staying here for a while.
Yeah.
So he got work in Yosemite as a sheep herder. One of his first jobs was herding 2,000 sheep up into the Sierras.
So much fun, I bet.
He hated it. He learned to hate sheep. He called them hooved locusts. And he started to despise sheep because he thought that they had a disproportionately bad impact on the natural surroundings. They just ate everything.
Well, they did. They kind of ravaged Yosemite to a large degree.
Right. So he came to kind of see livestock as an extension of human occupation of these wild lands and how detrimental it was. And it really occurred to him during this first little, you know, few month period where he was a sheep herder.
Yeah. And I think also the horse and the horses that led people on expeditions and stuff.
Yeah.
They also overgrazed, and the cattle overgrazed, and they were logging. And Yosemite was, I think it was under the care of the state of California. It was a state park at this point because it had been gifted by, well, not gifted, but it was a land grant from Abraham Lincoln in the middle of the Civil War to California.
He said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do for you.
You take Yosemite. But it was really mismanaged and just I mean, compared to what they're doing now, it was in a pretty bad state.
Yeah, which is one reason why John Muir was pushing for it to become a national park so that it would be under care of the federal government, who hopefully would enforce the laws of preservation a lot more than California had. So he shows up in Yosemite. He starts shepherding. But more than anything, the thing that he became known for was these jaunts where he would become like the first white man to scale Cathedral Rock.
Right.
He would like note all these fossil formations or take samples of them and send them back to like the newly forming University of California. He would like submit botany like descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was just basically like exploring Yosemite and documenting the whole place while at the same time taking notes for what would become a series of like books, essays. Like he really made his name as like a writer. Like he made a career for himself just as a writer. We think of him as like this conservationist naturalist, and that's where he was coming from. But at the time, he was a successful writer. And after he left Yosemite,
yeah, I mean, another big kind of central relationship for him was a man named Robert Underwood Johnson, who was the editor of Century Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And Century Magazine was very much a sort of a progressive naturalist rag. And he and we should say that this, you know, we're not like – this is the most interesting parts of his life. Like he also worked for a decade or more on once he got married, he married a woman named Louisa Wanda Strensel in 1880. And her family had had a couple of daughters, Wanda and Helen. And her family had a fruit farm. A fruit ranch, and he lived there in Martinez, California, and kind of quit doing his adventuring for a full decade and ran this farm and worked as a farmer. So all this stuff was going on, and then Robert Underwood Johnson basically doggedly pursued Muir and said, listen, man, we need you. You got to start writing again because you're the foremost naturalist in the country right now, according to me and only me.
Right.
And we need you to start writing some stuff and start pushing for political change. And he was working on this farm this whole time. And eventually he was like, all right, you know, what do you got for me?
So the reason Johnson sought him out was because he made a name for himself even while he was still living in Yosemite.
Yeah.
Like you can kind of look at Muir's life like he went and got all of the experience he could possibly need in these 6 years living basically that whole stretch in Yosemite.
Living and deliberately.
And then went and used that experience.
Mm. Yeah.
Is that like a Nomadland reference?
Living deliberately?
Yeah.
Now, wasn't that Thoreau?
Oh, yeah, okay.
I went to the woods deliberately.
Living Deliciously is from The Witch. but it was basically like, imagine if like you had like a crazy six-year period in your 20s. And then you spent the rest of your life exploiting that, writing about it, talking about it, making a name for yourself, being a cause celeb from that experience. That's basically what he did.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of people that did that.
Sure.
You know?
Who else?
I don't know. I can't think of one.
Well, Thoreau's a great example. He went and lived at Walden for, what, a year? And that was like, we're still talking about that guy today. You know?
Yeah, that's true.
And I've even heard that Walden Pond was like, town was right there.
Yeah, it's like the Pizza Hut next to the pyramids.
That's right. Kind of like that, but yeah.
Sort
of.
So Muir, another big important relationship that he made was with a president named Theodore Roosevelt. And Theodore Roosevelt is known for the 280 million acres of federal land that he protected, among other things. But Muir was a big reason why. I mean, Roosevelt was into preservation anyway. It's not like Muir came in and completely like changed his mind about everything.
Sure.
But Roosevelt knew about him and quite literally said, I would like you to take me camping in Yosemite for 4 days. Mm-hmm. He said, just the two of us.
Didn't they have to like give the Secret Service the slip?
Well, I think there was Secret Service there because apparently they just never shut up, and the Secret Service people in like one of their journals said like these two like won't shut up. All they're doing is just yammering at each other about the woods. So I don't know if they gave him the slip or not, but I know that originally the request was Roosevelt was like, I don't want anyone around, man. I just want you and I to get out there in the woods and like talk about this stuff.
Yeah, like wax mustache to wax mustache.
That's right. So he works hand in hand with Roosevelt to do a lot of work. I think one of the first national monuments they established was Petrified Forest in Arizona.
Which he went out there and was like, oh, this place is kind of cool. He moved there for his daughter's health, apparently. And while he was there, he's like, oh, there's a petrified forest. I'll just start submitting fossil specimens.
Did?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
He just did the same thing there as an older man that he did earlier at Yosemite.
Yeah, and I think the deal with Yosemite was because it was a state park, the actual Yosemite Valley wasn't part of the park boundaries.
Right.
Mariposa Grove of those giant sequoia trees wasn't actually part of the boundary. And Muir was like, man, this is what needs to be a part of the boundary more than anything.
Yeah, so that was one of the first things that the Sierra Club took up. It was like basically their first initiative. And John Muir is synonymous with the Sierra Club because he was the first president. He was for, I think,
his whole life.
Basically 20 years or something like that.
He died the rest of his life.
Yeah, he died in 1914, and he became the president of Sierra Club in 1892. So he helped found this organization that's still around today. And one of the first initiatives, one of their first pushes was to get the Yosemite Valley and the, what's the name of the forest?
The Mariposa?
Mariposa Forest.
Yeah.
The Sequoia Grove, included into the boundaries of the national park. And they were finally successful in 1906. And from that success, they just started having more and more successes and eventually expanded because initially they were focused on the West, basically.
Right.
Because that's where all these people who founded the club lived, and that's what they cared about. They said, well, there's other places where this battle needs to be fought as well.
Well, there's nice stuff.
And they became this national advocacy group that will sue your pants off if you try to mess with a national park.
Yeah, they opened an office in D.C. in 63, and like you said, went off, you know, Alaska, Florida. Very key in trying to get things like the Clean Air Act passed, the Wilderness Act, the EPA created in 1970. And Alaska's kind of key, too, in Muir's life because he gets engaged to Louie. Mm-hmm. And I think in those days, you kind of got engaged and got married pretty quickly. Like there weren't these long, drawn-out engagements.
Okay.
But there was in his case because he was like, all right, we're engaged. You are a good match. Thank you, Gene Carr. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to go to Alaska now.
All right.
And he did. He went to Alaska for a period. And if you think Alaska is like, you know, uncharted and wild now, like imagine what it was like back then.
I will.
I'm sure his diary was like,
what?
No snakes. Amazing.
Yeah.
What the heck is this place? But like I said, they eventually did get married and have those daughters. And she very sadly passed away in 1905 of cancer.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And he he had to go home to be with her when she died. Like he was away when she was partially for part of the time while she was sick.
Well, that's sad.
It's very, very sad.
I guess that explains why he and his daughters were the only ones that moved to Arizona for his daughter's health then. I guess that means that she had passed
by then. After 1905?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
That's sad. Because she supposedly was well known for her I saw that she was a very gentle person, a very sweet person.
Yeah, and very supportive of his efforts, like, mm-hmm. was truly a good match. She loved the wilderness and nature and God and all those things.
Oh, she loved God. Don't get her started on God.
Should we take our second break?
I think so.
All right.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health 8 kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health 8 Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
So we were talking about John Muir and the Sierra Club, Chuck, and it's really hard to understate what Muir's impact. No.
Okay.
Yes. What impact he had, because like I said, he was a successful writer. He was really good at writing, and also he did really crazy stuff, like riding an avalanche. There's a very famous essay that he wrote called A Windstorm in the Forest,
mm-hmm.
That he describes what it was like to climb up the top of a pine tree and hang on for hours during a storm in the Sierras.
Yeah.
And how awesome nuts it was. And like, just basically saying, like, this is real. This is nature. Like, you could,
yeah.
If you go out to these places, you could do this stuff. But this is not going to be around if we keep building railroads through
right.
these places, or we build dams, or we let livestock just graze wherever. Like, we can't just not do something about it. It has to be preserved and protected. And he inspired people during his lifetime and long after his lifetime as well.
Yeah, I think I watched a pretty cool American Masters documentary on this, and this one guy, historian, was like, there was a little bit of macho involved.
Mm.
Like, he was this great naturalist, not to take anything away, but like riding the avalanche and like climbing a tree during a snowstorm at the top or a rainstorm at the top of a mountain. He said there was a little like machismo involved in that. Like,
sure,
look
it's,
at me,
it's Hemingway-esque.
Man. Yeah, or Bodhi from Point Break.
Wait, was that Patrick
Swayze.
Yeah, or was it Keanu?
Keanu Reeves, that was Johnny Utah, my friend.
Oh, that's right. So Bodie was, or was that Flea from Red Hot Chili
Peppers?
That's right.
But it was actually Anthony
Kiedis
that was in Point Break.
Sure.
Flea may have been in it, but Kiedis was one of the ruffians that got his foot shot off.
I know. He was the leader of the bad guys surfer club.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think Flea was in that club. I think.
Well, was he naked except for a sock on his genitalia?
Probably.
Okay.
And pants made of teddy bears.
Did we take our second break?
Yeah, we just did, man.
Yeah, we sure did.
So, but I was leading up to something. So we've been talking about what a great guy John Muir was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he was looked at and respected for decades and decades, a century actually and more. He was looked at a great man, maybe a little macho, sure, but that's forgivable if that machismo is directed toward riding a tree in a storm rather than, you know, picking bar fights in Lisbon or something like that, you know?
Yeah, good point.
So, thank you. So when we did our episode on Girl Scouts, I talked about how, like, Juliette Gordon Low was one of those rare historic figures from a century or so ago that you were like, and actually she holds up today.
Right.
John Muir is not that same way. There is a real, I guess, a mea culpa.
Sort of a reckoning.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. That's exactly what it was, a reckoning by the Sierra Club not too many years ago, where they basically said, hey, John Muir was great in all these ways. He was also pretty racist. And yeah, he was a product of his time and the way of thinking, which we'll talk about. But he was still pretty racist. And in fact, the whole basis of the national park system was built on this racist ideology, and we're still basically looking at it the same way today.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the Sierra Club even acknowledged that our first years as a group was based on the notion of white people trying to protect the land that white people wanted to hike through,
right,
and enjoy as campers and recreationalists.
Yes.
And in his earlier years, I think kind of through his 30s, up until his 30s, he had sort of bad things to say about people of color, whether it was indigenous peoples in the United States or black people, and used disparaging language toward them, which the whole thing with the indigenous peoples is really counterintuitive because they were so aligned with his philosophies of how you inhabit a land and share a land and use it and don't abuse it. And, you know, it really doesn't make much sense. And supposedly I think in his 40s, he started to come around, especially when he went to Alaska, because they, indigenous people served as his guides and he started to learn more from them. And I think things turned around a bit at that point.
Yeah.
But, the Sierra Club, you know, spent a lot of time over the past few years trying to sort of bring this to light and not whitewash it and say, hey, this is what it was.
No, they did a very good job of it, actually.
I think so, yeah.
So I was saying that he was a product of his time, and he very much was.
Yeah.
There was an idea before his time, say the 1820s, 1830s, when the West was like the frontier.
Right.
And the United States didn't really need it at the time, where there was this view of the Native American as this noble race that was being encroached upon by humanity, and that we needed to preserve this wild area. This was decades before John Muir came around, this idea that we needed to preserve this stuff, but we also needed to preserve Native Americans and their culture in this land that we're preserving.
Right.
So the initial idea for national parks was that the Native Americans would live on this land just as they always had, and it would be their land, but it would also be America's national parks. It would be protected. And then the railroad came, and all of a sudden, the U.S. started expanding further and further west, faster and faster.
Yeah.
And now the Native Americans weren't this group of people over there that you could kind of idealize. They were now in the way of this westward expansion. So racism toward them went through the roof.
Yeah.
And now there was this idea that Native American culture was already dead, that the best of the culture had died in the last decades and centuries, and that it was all the white man's fault, but what's done is done. And so let's just make this decline into extinction as comfortable as possible and preserve Native Americans, not on our national park land, but we'll just make reservations for them to go over there and just die off. And it's sad, but that's just the way it is. And that is the mentality that John Muir became a conservationist within, the larger zeitgeist.
Right.
That you no human should be on the land. But in particular, Native Americans shouldn't be there anyway because this is our white people land.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm glad the Sierra Club and people in general are more comfortable calling this stuff what it is now. Like even in that American Masters, there was one line where they said like, you know, early on he I don't even remember what they said. I don't even think they said disparaging, but like he said some things weren't not so nice for Native American Indians is what they said.
Did he like cough it while he was saying it?
Yeah. And it was just very quickly like they wouldn't dare say that he had racist points of view.
Yeah.
You just didn't say stuff like that. But I think now people are more comfortable with saying – using that word and saying, you know, this is how he was for a time in his life.
Yeah.
And we gotta reckon with that because it's part of our history of a foundation.
For sure. And not just him. Like the national parks were – They evicted people.
Yeah.
And not just Native Americans, depending on where you were. Out west, Grand Canyon, Petrified Forest, Yosemite, Yellowstone, all of them required forced evictions to basically create this pristine area that was never pristine and free of human settlement or occupation or use. They created that to create the national parks. And they used, like, this idea. There was this – I read this really interesting article, dude, from 2007. Mm. So it would have been groundbreaking at the time. It's called Ethnic Cleansing and America's Creation of National Parks by Isaac Cantor. And Cantor points out that, like, the people who were setting up and promoting these first national parks like Yellowstone and Yosemite would say – there were never Native Americans here anyway.
That's
they were all
true.
These were all they were afraid of spirits in this, you know, in this canyon. So they never hung out here anyway. But by the way, can you send some military to protect us from Native American attacks while we're setting up this national park?
Yeah.
So it's
like, which is it?
Yeah, basically. But that's a really interesting. It was a really good read, and it was very eye opening, especially for 2007.
So I guess in closing, we want to quickly mention one of his last. What he was actually trying to do when he died and failed at doing was preventing the damming of the Hetch Hetchy Valley in Yosemite. And basically what happened in 1906 was there was a devastating earthquake and fire that destroyed San Francisco, which I'd love to cover that as its own episode at some point.
Yeah, totally.
Basically completely destroyed it.
And Rice-a-roni everywhere.
And one of the reasons that the fire destroyed it was because their water – what do you call them?
Water people?
Their water system. I'll just say that.
Sure.
Was destroyed by the earthquake.
Oh, yeah.
So San Francisco said, we need a better, more reliable water supply, and we can get it in Yosemite with the Hetch Hetchy Valley if we dam that thing up. And he was like, you can't do this. It's in a national park.
Mm-hmm.
And he lost that effort, but he made such a stink. He was basically like, there are a lot of other ways you can get water. You're just doing this because it's easiest and cheapest.
Mm-hmm.
But you can get water to San Francisco in other ways. And like I said, he was not successful. He did lose that battle and then passed away of pneumonia at the age of 76 in 1914. There hasn't been a dam built on national parkland since then.
Yeah, because that battle, even though he lost it, it really raised awareness, and it also kind of set a certain mindset in people's, the public's mind that, no, you don't really mess with national parks. And I guess we had to lose one to get to that point.
That's right.
You got anything else?
I got nothing else.
So that's John Muir for you, everybody. Go check out his writings and read about him and see what you think. And also don't forget Ethnic Cleansing and the Creation of America's National Parks. Good stuff. And since I said good stuff, of course, it's time for Listener Mail.
This is on Cleft Palates from Malcolm.
Ooh, that's new.
In Calgary.
That came out today.
Alberta.
Okay.
Canada.
USA.
North America, Earth. Hey guys, been an avid listener since my friend introduced me on a very hungover car ride home from an Iron Maiden concert about 5 years ago.
Nice.
That's a great way to get turned on to the show.
Yeah.
I thought I'd write in to share my experience with my son's cleft palate after listening to the episode. My son was born with a midwife in June 2019 and had a ton of trouble breastfeeding, which in hindsight was because he couldn't get any suction. A couple of days later, the midwife noticed what she thought was a cleft in the soft palate. We took our newborn to the hospital, and she was right. We became regulars at the Alberta Children's Hospital's cleft clinic in Calgary, Alberta, and 2 years later, my son has had a surgery to repair his cleft palate and another to put tubes in his eardrums. Parentheses, socialized healthcare is the best. The tubes are common with clefts because the muscles that drain the ear canals don't form properly, so the tubes allow fluid to leave the ear canals. One thing you didn't mention was the bifid uvula, which I have. It's related to clefts in that the muscles don't quite form properly, and it makes your uvula look more like a W than a teardrop.
I saw that in research. I forgot to mention.
I did too. I can't believe I forgot that. We are currently visiting a geneticist at the hospital to see if cleft and my bifid uvula are genetically related, but I think the answer is probably yes. Love listening to you guys. Look forward to each episode. That is Malcolm.
Nice. Nice name, Malcolm. That's great. Thank you very much for sharing, and also rock on, Maiden.
Yeah, that's your name, Malcolm.
Yeah, it's my middle name.
Great name.
Sure.
Me and my friends the other night were hanging out, me and Emily and Justin and Melissa. Uh-huh. We were having a few drinks, and we decided to start only going by our middle names.
Oh, yeah.
So it was Alex, Don, Renee, and Wayne. Were hanging out for the rest of the night. We were just cracking jokes, like someone would say something and be like, that is so Alex.
That's a fun thing.
I don't know if it's going to stick, but it was really weird to think of myself as a Wayne.
That could be a one-night thing. That
I think
just happened
so.
That one night. If I think, it sticks, I will be really surprised.
I think I determined that you don't have a relation to your middle name, like an emotional connection, if when you hear that name out loud, you don't have any reaction. Like if I hear someone say a Chuck or someone else's Chuck, I go, oh. But if I hear someone say Wayne or whatever, it doesn't even register.
You're like, that name is dead to me.
Yeah.
Sure.
That sounds about right, right?
Sure.
All right. So, Malcolm.
Well, if you want to get in touch with us like Malcolm did, not me, the other Malcolm.
One in the middle.
You can send us an email like Malcolm did to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.